Welcome to the Metaphysical Martini Show, where wit and wisdom come together to bridge the gap between the spirit realm and the physical world.
With Ani Avedisian, the Mad Shaman, a production of CosmicReality.com.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ani Avedisian. Welcome to Metaphysical Martini. Three parts spirit, one part rational mind. Add two drops of optimism, give it all a good hard shake and pour, dress it with the olives of grace and empathy, sit back, sip slowly, and contemplate the wonder of cosmic co-creation. And a hearty hello to you all. Hello, hello, hello. Thanks for joining me for yet another round of cocktails on this week's Metaphysical Martini, the show that tries to sort out what's true, what's woo, and what gets flushed down the loo. In a world so lost up its own arse, common sense is rare and sparse. A world so unwilling to meet itself halfway, the Democrats, or what's left of them, are considering funding a movement to make Ugandan hedgehogs gay. A world so populated by many imbeciles and cowards, they believe being poorly educated gives them grace and superpowers. A world so lost and so wayward, people are dressing up as animals in Portland and begging to be tasered. And the most amusing thing of all, upon arrest, for me at least, is how they squeal and bawl. Welcome back, Martini Heads. I raise my glass to you. Lovely to be with you all again. If you're joining us for the first time, be advised this show is politically incorrect so as not to erode the intellect. We are a strange bunch of people, we Martini Heads, but we are essentially spirit-centered patriots from all walks of life. We don't do woke. We know the agenda behind the death poke. We don't, as far as I know, do drugs or coke. But Metaphysical Martini is where the Holy Spirit meets top shelf distilled spirits. And what a delightful, nay, what a celestial combination that is. In fact, my darlings, why don't I have a little sip of today's drinky poo to see if it's a winner or a sinner? Hold on, darlings, don't go away. Sipping is happening. Ooh, very pleasant. Very, very refreshing. And it might make me burp, so I apologize in advance. That is a lovely drink, which we will talk about more towards the end of the show. And the show, what is the show today? What are we going to do? What do we have for you on today's martini? Well, let's start, as we nearly always do, with quack. Questions, answers, and comments. And then we'll follow that up with one of my poems, you know, the literary masterpieces, each and every one. And then we'll follow that up with Paranormal Americana. And we'll end, as we always do, with my favourite part of the day, an explanation, description, and rhapsody on the cocktail of the day. So let's get on with it then, shall we? Let's get on with the show and let's move into quack, questions, answers, and comments. Friends, if you would like to share the contents of your minds with Martini Heads across the known universe, send your emails to me, Ani at aniavedisian.com, or via snail mail to Cosmic Ani, P.O. Box 714, Wilsonville, Oregon 97070, USA. And don't forget to let me know if and how you wish to be identified, or I shall refer to you as Omit Personal Details. Now, no subject is off limits. We don't do taboo. We want to hear your worldview. But obviously, if you're a sick, kinky bastard with weird sexual habits, we don't want to know about that sort of thing, okay? We want to know about things that will advance mankind. So I'm going to be shaking up this fishbowl here, the fishbowl of perpetual perplexity, and let's see what pops out. Shaky, shaky, shake those little papers, baby. Woohoo! right, let's see what we got first here. Our first one is from Secret Squirrel, who currently lives in Oxford in the United Kingdom. And Secret Squirrel enjoyed my last podcast on Tartaria, Truth or Trash. And so Secret Squirrel sent me his or her ideas, because this is a very secret identity. So Secret Squirrel says, let's say Tartaria existed. Number one, they mastered vibrations and tuning. Yes, indeed, they did. The whole premise is that they got free energy out of the air. Number two, human body is a radio receptor for the souls. Hey, thought the Tartarians, maybe we can redirect that. Well, you can direct it for good or redirect it for good or bad. That much we do know. And with all the 5G and the graphite in people's bodies these days and all the strange things that they told us could never be done, which are being done to people, this is very good thinking, Secret Squirrel. They understood the human body is the only way the soul functions here. Number three, oh, hey, we can blip into our own little Eden with no disease, suffering, or death. Wouldn't that be lovely? And assuming Tartaria existed, at least in the way that we think it did, and they were really onto that free energy and keeping your aura clear so that you never actually got sick. You know, we're not supposed to get sick. Did you know that? We're not really supposed to get sick if we really believe in our divinity. Illness is a misalignment. But moving on with Secret Squirrel's list of Tartarian things. Number four, lets us all go exist. Okay, I see. We all exist here, but leave some maintenance men on the outside. They can maintain our equipment. I understand. I know these are little phrases you put together, and you probably didn't want me to read them out quite like this, but I understand exactly where you're going. You're looking at all the different scenarios. Excuse me, and all the different angles, pro Tartaria, con Tartaria. Number five, she says, oh, we can't die, so we've got to limit who comes in. But that's boring. We also want fresh people. Let's have a controlled paradise realm migration, and let's kidnap babies. Well, I think you might be onto something there if the Tartarian thing is true, and they did lose all these people in the mudflats. Where did all the babies come from? The Cabbage Patch babies. So, and let's move them to places where there's no population. Perfectly feasible. Number six, political arguments in the paradise realm. People also get weird from isolation. Well, the lockdowns didn't help. I know what you're getting at. And you know, depending on who's controlling the paradise realm, if someone is actually controlling it and it's a controlled paradise, they will allow a certain amount of argument in politics within certain parameters. Number seven, thought from Secret Squirrel says, hey, what are our men on the outside even doing? Let's mess around. Serfs aren't really people. We're all just vibration, and we've mastered that. Nothing matters. Imagine how people are. You can imagine it, I'm sure. Very interesting. Now we're really getting into thinking selective morality, I think, is what we're getting into here. And these people that we call the elites, they're really the sociopaths. They don't have any empathy in the way that we do. We have over empathy, suicidal empathy on this planet currently. But I get what you're saying, Secret Squirrel. You know, serfs aren't really people. Number eight, men on the outside. Hey, we want in. And or, hey, we can take advantage of things. Hey, we need to make some of this stuff disappear. Let's mess around. Whatever you can imagine what people are like, and we live here, and so we're doing what they're doing. I'm understanding your thought process here. And number nine, everyone else, the serfs, go about life, but not completely unaware, because we keep coming up with technology fairy tales about the nerd singularity, etc., and we keep noticing things that don't make sense. Okay, Secret Squirrel. To the rest of the world, and possibly because of the way I read that, that might have sounded like nonsense. But to me, it makes perfect sense because you are asking all the questions that need to be asked about all the different mindsets that go with analyzing and decoding this whole Tartarian thing. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. It is a very big rabbit hole to go down, isn't it? I have to say, though, specifically, I mean, I can point to this question from, or you know, this little epic, paraphrasing here from Secret Squirrel. It has made people think. I mean, Tartaria's trending, and that's exciting for no other reason than it means people are thinking way outside the box, which is a very good thing. Now, I don't buy into the Tartaria theory, hook, line, and sinker. But there are very big questions here that need to be asked. I do remember as a young girl standing outside of some of these very intricately carved, apparently by hand, cathedrals all over Europe and going, Daddy, are you sure this was made by hand in the 12th century? Anyway, thank you again, Secret Squirrel, and hello to you there in Oxford. I hope England sorts itself out soon. What else came in this week? Let's see. Ah, this is from Jeremy. Jeremy's also from the UK. He's in Dover. Ah, the white cliffs of Dover. And Jeremy in Dover, UK, asks one simple question. Why do we have so many names for God? And does it matter which ones we use? Why do we have so many names for God? And does it matter which one we use? Doesn't matter which name we use, because every single life form, no matter what its level of awareness, no matter what its state of mind, is a manifestation of what we call God. And here's the thing, how does one correctly address something which is not fully understood? It's easy to say, God is the allness, Alpha, Omega, everything in between. Oh, mighty creator, or simply the almighty, all that is. Can a human grasp the eternal, unlimited nature of such a being? I think not. And that's why we personify deity. It gives us a focus point, something our mind can wrap itself around and have a conversation with. We will eventually, one hopes, self-realize and understand that there is no such being as God, but not the type of God we have been told exists. That's a story created to help less advanced races, a stepping stone into self-discovery until we move away from the idea of an external God and move into the idea of being representatives of a living, eternal, universal family. Our prayer time moves away from, Dear God, please would you, to a more focused internal dialogue where, knowing we are an intrinsic part of universal energy, we are on equal footing with the deity formerly known as God. We are not waiting for God to come down and bless us with its almighty grace. We have risen up to meet God at the divine frequency and operate as one eternal, magnificent energy. And ultimately, as we continue to embody the divine vibe, we lose the concept of deity altogether and simply go about our lives treating every interaction as a sacred interaction without all the ritual and the drama and the false respect. So, no, in my opinion, it doesn't matter how you address God. What matters is that you understand your place within God. Okay, I think that was a fairly decent explanation of what's going on in my head. What else came in today? What else came in today? This is an email from Margot in Edmonton, Canada, who asks, Ani, how do you tell the difference between ego and spirit when having internal dialogue? That, I think, I could write 25,000 pages on it or just give you this one simple hint. If there is any hint of self-deprecation or victimhood, it's the ego. Spirit guides, ego goads. Spirit thrills, ego shills. That's the simplest explanation I can give. And that's how you'll know. Thanks for that one, Margot in Edmonton, Canada. That's actually a very good question. And now we have the inevitable question from a fellow American Armenian. this is from, in America it's Levon, in Armenian it's Levon. So this is from Levon, who sent me a postcard from Toronto, Canada. Dear Ani, what are your views and concerns on the current political situation in Armenia? And then he wrote in slightly smaller script, the Turks will win, you know. I'll start off by saying this. I currently have no meaningful input into the minutiae of the political situation. However, I am aware of what's going on. I am aware of the mechanics. I'm aware of the role playing. And I ask myself often, how will this little country survive and thrive in the years to come? And before I get into the spiritual, metaphysical aspect of it, I will also just come right out and say, I know the Azerbaijanis and the Turks would wipe Armenia off the map if they could get away with it. I know that probably one of the railroads that's going to go through this great Trump highway or whatever is quite possibly going to be packed with troops, explosives, or whatever they think they can get away with. My point being, I am an American. My loyalties are here. This is where the battle is fought for the planet. But as someone with Armenian blood, I don't deny they would slaughter every last one of us if they could get away with it. So let me bring myself out of all of that back into the present. And how would I give a response as a spiritual counselor? I would say different parties have different ideas about Armenia's future. And I will say, and this always makes me very unpopular, but like I've ever cared about that, you cannot build a stable future on gaping, bleeding wounds. People are quite rightly concerned for their survival, personal and ethnic survival, cultural survival. And I'm not going to go into ego and all of that, but we can't deny there is more than a whiff of genocide complex in the air. That's what I mean by a deep and gaping wound. Victimhood. Everybody fucks everybody over at some point on this planet. I will say not being an Armenian citizen gives me a great deal of detachment. I'm not somebody who believes in dual citizenship or split loyalties. But I will just say, since we often boast, Armenians in general, often boast, at every available opportunity, actually boast of becoming the first nation to adopt Christianity as a state religion, perhaps we could take the advice of one Emmanuel, who encouraged us to make peace with our past so that it has no effect on the present, which in turn allows for an inspired future. Rather than get wrapped up in deep emotional turmoil, wounds of the past and all that, I advise us all to step back and see who has the better plan for ensuring Armenian sovereignty and continuity of culture. We can't let past grievances destroy our chance of happiness in the future. We certainly can't survive as an island. As a nation, some deep, prayerful contemplation is in order. The world is changing. We can forgive and move on. Or we can sit on our wounds and let them fester until sepsis takes over. Emmanuel taught that forgiveness dissolves karma. If we understand the meaning of that, and it feels good to us, then we are ready to negotiate and be on cordial terms with our former enemies. Enmity is an error in perception. Forgiveness and thought for an inspired future is the correction. So whoever has the best plan to ensure the survival of Armenia as a nation, a sovereign nation, please step forward. Everybody else, Try to be as calm and objective as possible as you listen to the plans. And ask yourselves, do you hate the Turks and the Azerbaijanis more than you love your country? Because over here in my country, in America, we have deranged fucking lunatics who hate Trump so much. They don't care if a whole nation burns to the ground, just as long as they can indulge their loathing, which is, of course, a reflection of the self. It ends when we decide to grow up. It ends when we are not at war within ourselves. When we are sovereign citizens as individuals, then perhaps we can make a contribution to the continuity of our culture. With all my heart and soul, I bless my heritage. I love my heritage. I have no problem being Armenian. Otherwise, I wouldn't have chosen to be born of Armenian blood. But we're at a crossroads right now. We can't sit there and go, Turks, 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 even though we're surrounded by Turks, Turks, Turks. We have to make better allies. And we have to have a different attitude to what it means, Armenia's survival past 2025. Okay, thank you for that question. I hope I didn't offend anyone. Probably I did, and I'll be getting mail about it. But you know what? If you want my opinion, I'll always give it. If you're upset by it, terribly sorry. This is from Alyssa in Brunswick, New Jersey, where they have that stew, Brunswick stew. Dear Arnie, if you could possess only one book in your life and were allowed no others ever, which one would it be? Oh, come on, Alyssa. That is an impossible question. I mean, I'm sitting here in my home office, surrounded by hundreds of books. How could I choose only one? I mean, in my current lifestyle, the way I live, the way I work, the way I need them for all my reference to teach my classes, etc., it's an impossible question to answer. However, if you had said, Arnie, you are stranded on a tropical island and can have only one book, well, then I could say, okay, give me 101 uses for surplus coconuts, or how to prevent shark attacks while survival fishing. But as the question stands for my current lifestyle, Alyssa, I thank you for the question and your interest, but I have to pass on this one because I cannot make that choice. A little sip of my drinky poo. Very refreshing. Okay, let's see. Let's pick another one. Excuse me, people. The bubbles get stuck in my throat sometimes. Okay. This is from Omit Personal Details, who asks, I am curious to know your views on busing. Well, in the 6 years or whatever that I've been doing this podcast, nobody has ever asked me that question. Where did that come from? Well, I assume you are referring to desegregation busing, the 1970s, I think. Would you like to know my ideas on that one? Okay. I don't think it was a good idea. And I'm not going to say because all the white schools went bad. And no, that's not what I meant at all. I don't think it's a good idea because I don't think government should decide where our children are educated. That's the only reason I disagree with it. Education should be a private matter. Parents should be able to send their children to whatever school they please. Because look what happens when the government plays politics with our children. Look at the transgender madness. No, I don't think anyone thinks busing was a good idea. I think better teachers, perhaps, and a different outlook on that. You just stop messing with the children. We're sick of it. But thank you for that question, Omit. Let's move on to another one. And this one, it comes to us from Kansas City, Missouri, and this is from Anatoly. Well, there's a good Midwestern name. Здравствуйте, товарищ. Anatoly in Kansas City, Missouri. Dear Arnie, do you agree with Ayn Rand's view of altruism? Well, you must know that I like reading Ayn Rand, otherwise you couldn't have just picked this out of the blue. Let me have a sip of this rather lovely drink. Okay, let's start off by reviewing the dictionary definition of altruism so that we're all on the same page. Unselfish concern for the welfare of others, selflessness. Instinctive behavior that is detrimental to the individual, but favors the survival or spread of that individual's genes as by benefiting its relatives. And three, regard for others, both natural and moral, devotion to the interests of others, brotherly kindness, opposed to egoism and selfishness. And you may say to yourself, why would anyone have a problem with that? I think she would have a problem with number two, instinctive behavior that is detrimental to the individual, and the individual being the smallest minority, and Rand was very big into sovereignty. If I remember correctly, she once referred to altruism as an unspeakable evil. The point here, I think, is, according to Rand, that we are here for our own purpose. And the goal is to pursue our own happiness. Being a bleeding heart, someone who puts themselves second and would allow themselves to be harmed in order to provide for another. That notion of sacrifice sounds glorious for a wannabe 11th century Christian martyr. But to someone who understands the insidious nature of the dark side of the mind, such a notion of sacrifice is abhorrent to the self-aware soul, although Ayn Rand would not have used the word soul. So to answer your question, I share Rand's view of what is and what is not noble. I'm always prepared to help those who need my help. But of course, I come first, because if I did not, I wouldn't be offering the best version of myself, would I? And that really is all she meant. And we could get deeper into that. We could say, how do you know, Arnie, that mankind is intrinsically good? That altruism is a natural thing and not an indoctrinated behavior, some sort of warped coding, some sort of warped notion they put into our heads? What tells you that the Big Bang was unconditional love? What tells you that that is the correct vibration and that everything else is a misalignment to it? You know, you can, and you should, go down these rabbit holes. Go down them alone with your own version of your own higher self first, before you discuss this with others. Because we really do beam down for very selfish reasons. But if we stick to our soul contracts, then we have honored the contracts we made with the others who are going to have relationships with us on this planet, and allow them to stick to their soul contracts and honor their soul contracts. Okay, thank you for that question. I'm moving on. Shall we take another one? Let's do it, because let me give the fishbowl a shake. We skipped quack on the last show because I was into Tartaria, actually. So we got a few more than usual today. Let's see what we got here. Ah, yes, this is from Lady Damiana of the Wastelands. Sounds a bit like one of my gamer friends to me, but I don't know who this is. Well, obviously, it's Lady Damiana of the Wastelands. Dear Arnie, this question is 100% serious. Have you ever had a sexual encounter with a demon or other dark spirit? Lady Damiana, no. Ick. It's not really my thing, darling, and we'll just leave it at that. And let's take one more today. Let's take one more. Let's make it a good one. I've got three left here. Okay, which one shall I pick? Okay, eeny, meeny, meeny, eeny. Let's pick this one. This is from Russell in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where the lights all went out once. To your knowledge, has anyone ever regrown a limb? If not, do you see it happening in our lifetime? We're having some fun little questions lately. Keep it up, people. Keep it up. I'm enjoying this. Russell, to my knowledge, no. But that doesn't mean anything, because I don't know everything. Do I see it happening in our lifetime? I don't know. Russell, how old are you? I'm 66. I mean, it will happen when people can see themselves as light particles. That is exactly when it will happen, when people realize that they are these subatomic photon particly things, and everything physical is non-physical, and everything's always moving. And when we actually realize, scientifically or spiritually or both, that we are light in motion, then when that is a primary vibe amongst the collective psyche, that is when you'll see people regrowing limbs. In fact, people just might go mad with it. They might go, I'll just chop off my leg and see if I can regrow a better one. You know, who knows? I mean, look around you. The world is insane. But that was a good question. They were all good questions. And with that, we conclude Quack questions, answers, and comments. Probably some of the worst kazoo playing you'll ever hear in the world, but I'm proud of it. And that is the end of Quack. Big smoochy woochie to everyone who wrote in and shared their wisdom. We wouldn't have a show without you. And now, my darlings, as I continue to sip this luxurious libation, I think it's time for a tiny pat of poetry. Another little sip for me. It's very windy today here in Oregon, and I went for a walk, and I think I swallowed many little leaves on the way home. Here we go, darlings. It's time for a tiny pat of poetry. Yes, folks, after a hard day's shamaning, I like nothing better than coming home, putting my feet up, and writing really good and occasionally brilliant poetry, non-peer-reviewed poetry, because I'm sure we can all agree my offerings are without peer. So here's one I wrote a couple of days ago about the process of aging. Now, I don't want you to all to think that I'm getting into the whole aging thing. It's just a progression. Sometimes the neurons don't fire as fast. You forget things. And I'm taking steps to make sure that that is not going to progress. I'm doing all the little brain exercises, going on power walks, and all of that. So, this is called It Happens to the Best of Us, but there is a way to slow it down. Me, 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 me. Here we go. It started about a year ago. I'd walk into a room and draw a blank. At first, I blamed it on the Bordeaux and admonished my mind for playing pranks. But at least once a day, I misplace some trinket, or my keys, my coffee, my cell phone, or purse. The other day, I lost a whole biscuit. There must be a way this can be reversed. I do crosswords on weekends and daily Tai Chi. I'm deep breathing and smashing through puzzles. I walk, I stretch, I drink herbal tea. I eat vegetables imported from Brussels. I want to reignite the spark in my neurons. I want a mind that is fresh, bright, and sharp. I don't want to end up a fussy old moron waiting for a cloud and a harp. If I say so myself, my darlings, I sort of enjoyed that. That was fun. If you find yourself slowing down, etc., yes, okay, it's inevitable, but you don't have to push it along. Make a list of all the things that have changed in your habits, you know, forgetfulness, this, that, the other, and then have some practical ideas about, you know, make sure you always put your keys back, you know, where they're supposed to be. Make sure that your underwear is in the underwear drawer. This, do little things to make your lives easier. Accept that you're aging, but don't go down the rabbit hole of expecting daily deterioration. Do it the other way. Expect incremental improvement daily. All right. Well, what should we do now? She says in a very high-pitched voice. Yeah, I think it's time for Paranormal Americana. Ooh, the segment where we explore the weird and wonky things that go bump in the night. And I know we have changed the name of the segment 100 times, but Paranormal Americana is it, people. We're sticking to that now. And I think today we will discuss the Shanghai tunnels in Portland, Oregon. And we'll do that because, well, they're very famous, but they're also just about a 30-minute drive north of my home in Wilsonville, Oregon, and I've taken tours of the tunnels on three separate occasions. And yes, I have to say, even after the cleanup and all the guided tours, it is still kind of funky down there, with some ghost peeps floating in and out and some residual hauntings and a general air of woe and hopelessness, and there's good reason for it. You see, in downtown Portland, underneath all of the shops and the restaurants, what the tourists don't understand is under their feet is a series of 150-year-old tunnels, and they connect to the basements of the city's oldest buildings, all the way down to the Willamette River, as well as to Portland's notorious Chinatown. Now, the tunnels were built by Chinese workers during the time when Chinatown was the center for trade business. So what they built them for originally was cargo, wasn't it? Transporting goods from cargo ships to the inner city. So by using the tunnels, the crews wouldn't have to go through inner city traffic. And it was good for business. And everybody thought this was a wonderful idea. But unbeknownst to most of the good people of Portland, the tunnels had a much more nefarious use. Back in the day, Portland was a smaller town, but the port was very, very large, still is, and can support many ships. So you had cargo ships sailing for months across the Pacific before unloading in Portland. Now, when sailors, you know, got a little bit of shore leave, they didn't have a lot of downtime before they had to, you know, reset and resail again and do it all over again. And back in the day, I suppose our sailors weren't as educated as they are today because they spent all of their free time on shore drinking and fighting in the saloons. And some of the sailors actually tried to make a run for it and said, I'm not going back to sea after that. So they'd go into the saloons, get drunk, and then, you know, get lost. So this was a problem, a really big problem, getting people to work on these ships and go to sea for long periods of time where there's nothing to do. It's terribly boring. It left the sea captains with a lot of empty positions to fill. And they couldn't get it done. They couldn't get staffed. And that's where we got the term Shanghai. Because these captains, they would hire what we call in England hard men, has nothing to do with their willies, you know, hard men, strong men, like, you know, bouncer type men, to Shanghai sailors to get them replacement sailors. And they would pay up to $50 a head. So the sailors would come into the bars and they would stand by the bars and they would drink a ridiculous amount of beer. And also these Shanghaiers, as they were called, the Shanghaiers, would go in there, watch their targets, wait until they were absolutely drunk, and then take them down to the basement. So, hey, mate, you want a something or whatever? I've got a girl you can bonk down there or whatever they used. They take them down, knock them unconscious, drag them through the Shanghai tunnels to the docks. And once they found they woke up and they were on the ship and the ship was already, you know, afloat, what were they going to choose? If they refused to work, then they were just put into a hold and they were starved to death. So that's where we get the whole Shanghai tunnels for. Now, it wasn't just about getting sailors either. You've got this underground network of tunnels and you can move anything you want in any quantity, in double quick time, without anyone seeing you. So it was only a matter of time before we had a different kind of human trafficking, because, you know, knocking sailors out cold and making them work, that's human trafficking, right? But they also did it to women who didn't make very good sailors, but apparently made very good prostitutes in their minds. So that was a thing. And then they started using it to abduct women and children, because young child slaves can fetch a great deal of money on the black market for, you know, they have many, many uses. And sometimes when these sailors, and sometimes even the women, when they weren't knocked out and dragged downstairs, they actually had trapdoors in some of these bars where, it'd be crowded, full of sailors, all, next to each other, everyone drinking tons of beer. Trapdoor would open, boom, they fall down into the tunnels, pitch black. They would have their shoes taken away from them, and broken glass was all over the tunnels. So this was a really nasty operation. All sorts of bad things, and people were, were trafficked through these tunnels, and people died there as well, of course. So of course they're haunted. Now, all of this is terrible. It's dreadful to know that we treat each other like this. But here's the worst part of it, is that they were operational until about 1947. And you can't operate a business like this successfully unless law enforcement and politicians are protecting you. So you had to know that law enforcement were being bribed to allow the trafficking of not just goods and drugs, but women and children. And you have to know that the mayor of the town knew, and anybody of note was paid off, and they allowed this to happen. Which I think is interesting why Portland still is today, I think, in one of the top three for human trafficking. We don't use the tunnels anymore. We don't need to. It's all done in the open. So, when you go down and you visit the tunnels, you'll have a tour guide. You're not allowed on your own, by the way. You'll have a tour guide, and there are a few little tricks that they've done there. I found remote controls to make doors move, etc. But if you can get past that, and if you actually are an intuitive, you will see a couple of residual hauntings. And depending on which tour you take and where you go, you will feel the sense of hopelessness down there. And, hundreds of people have tried to clear it, and it's a lot better than it was. But so many of the tunnels have been blocked off. You can't get to them. And God knows, what is on the other side of those walls. But if you have a business in Chinatown or a business in certain parts of Portland, and you have a basement, boy, I would say you've got a 60, 70% chance of, on the other side of that wall, you have one of these tunnels. I worked in Portland when I first came to the Pacific Northwest. I worked in such a building, and yeah, there was stuff going on there. So today it's mainly a tourist attraction. But at its heyday, maybe about 2,000 people or more a year were shanghaied through those underground tunnels, which doesn't sound like a lot for today, but really that's a lot of people. And the people that resisted were beaten up and starved and left for dead within the tunnels. You will certainly feel that. Gangs used the tunnels, to have their disagreements. And they also punished naughty gang members by treating them in the same way with, the broken glass and putting them in the dark. I mean, it's just bad shit, man. It's really bad. But if you come to Portland and you want to visit it, hook yourself up with Portland Ghost Tours. They will set you up, and I think a guided tour is about $30, and it's worth it because you get the whole history of it. And again, if you are an intuitive, go in there with a very open mind and a very clear aura, and do make some notes of what you find in there, because it's exciting to have all the different accounts from different people, different levels of awareness and what they see. Fun stuff. Portland Ghost Tours, they'll set you up. My darlings, oh my gosh, I think we're almost there for today. Almost. I've almost finished my drink, and that generally means the end of the show. So let me finish it so we can wrap up here. Hang on. That is a perfectly lovely cocktail. I think more of a summer cocktail, and we are definitely into fall here. But darlings, today's real life was the very aptly named Skeleton Key Cocktail. And here's how you make it. You take 1.5 ounces of bourbon. My go-to is Maker's Mark, but you use what you want. 3/4 of an ounce of Saint-Germain elderflower liqueur, very useful item in your bar. 1/2 ounce of freshly squeezed lemon juice. 3 to 5 ounces of good ginger beer. And 6 to 8 dashes of Angostura bitters, which I know you're all going, no, that's a lot. No, for this drink, it is not a lot. And this is a drink that you do not make in a shaker. You make it in a glass. So get yourself a highball glass. Put cracked ice in it. Pour in the bourbon. Pour in the elderflower liqueur, the Saint-Germain, and the lemon juice. And then top it with the ginger beer. Then put in the 6 dashes of Angostura bitters and just give it the merest little swizzle with your finger to move the ice. You don't even have to do that if you don't want. And then just sip it really slowly. It doesn't need to be dressed. You can if you wish. But it's a lovely long drink and it doesn't knock you on your ass, which is always a good thing. Remember, folks, cocktails are great if they are an occasional treat. If you use top shelf ingredients and take the art of mixology seriously, one drink, Arnie Avedisian, one drink is all you need. I raise my glass to Mystical Wares in Mount Vernon, Washington, your one-stop shopping experience for all things metaphysical. And if you don't live in Mount Vernon, Washington, visit their website, www.mysticalwares.com, because online or on location, you'll be sure to give them a standing ovation. Huzzah for Mystical Wares! Huzzah! I am Ani, mad as the day is long, Avedisian. This was Metaphysical Martini, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio, to whom we are most grateful. Mwah! Until we meet again, please enjoy watching the lunatic fringe binge on their cringe. And if you find yourselves having too much fun with that, remind yourselves to let the spirit inhabit the human.
Have been listening to The Metaphysical Martini with Ani Avedisian, the Mad Shaman, a production of CosmicReality.com.